friends. It has been a while. I had to take some unannounced time away because, well, first, let me say that I've been really struggling with how much I should actually share in this platform. I'm so grateful for all you listeners. Tell Her This is well on its way to 100,000 downloads, being listened to in more than 150 countries each week. There's something incredibly special happening, and I'm so proud and so grateful. But I must also be honest and share that this isn't a sustainable project. It's not being monetized. I just don't have the people power. In addition to the 3 to 4 hour storytelling sessions for each storyteller, I spend another 15 or so hours actually editing each episode, working in Logic, editing audio, recording, selecting songs. This, on top of my work as a music artist, bandmate, music arts consultant, etc., etc. I want to keep creating and sharing these incredible stories because we are really building something here and I'm not complaining. And so I need to hire someone. I need a producer, a thought partner, someone with an ear for storytelling, someone who can help me expand Tell Her This. Experience with brand partnerships or audio editing skills is a big plus. If this sounds like you or someone you know, please send me an email at tellherthispodcast@gmail.com. Okay, this week's episode is extra special. If you're following on social media, you know that I traveled up to Massachusetts to host my very first Tell Her This storytelling workshop. I'll link a video about that in the show notes. Whilst in Massachusetts, I sat with the Karen Casey, activist, musician, beautiful soul. This episode is a gift. All right, let's get started. Restless
wanderer. This is Tell Her This podcast. Why won't you unfold? My name is Karen Casey and I'm 55.
Karen Casey is a singer, songwriter, storyteller, and has had a career of more than 30 years, weaving her way between her roots in Irish traditional music, her study of jazz, and her longtime relationship with the American-born supergroup Solas. Karen has dedicated her solo career to women's rights and justice, particularly in Ireland. With 11 albums under her belt, numerous collaborations and tours across the globe, I got to sit down with this beautiful yet unassuming woman before her concert in Northampton, Massachusetts at Bombix Live. These are her stories.
I think I'm probably a more confident woman who is kind of coming into her own after years probably of pleasing people, struggling kind of to fit in or belong, and really only beginning to kind of come into my own true self. I feel like I've kind of returned to my 13-year-old self, where I was pretty rebellious, wanted to forge my own path and change the world for the better. I grew up in a very small village called Ballyduff Lower, and it was about 8 miles outside the nearest town. And my father had come from another village the other way, like 8 miles that way, called Kilmac. So he was very local, but in fairness, 8 miles in Ireland is a long way, actually. And my mother was from Dublin originally, but they had both emigrated to London for work. They loved London, they really loved it. Then my mother got pregnant with me, actually, and they came home and they were married, and moved back to Waterford. And so we grew up, they moved a lot in the early days and they had a hairdressing business. My dad was a hairdresser, much to the disgust of my mother's family. They were like, you must be joking, she's marrying a barber. Eventually, they moved to a place called Ballyduff. And it was pretty idyllic. It was out in the countryside, very small. People looked after each other. And I learned how to sing really there because I had a great teacher there. Winifred Forne was her name. And she taught the whole class how to sing. My dad is a great singer. He loved singing. We had loads of parties in our house.
Karen grew up with music, a full house of singing and community. Eventually, she began singing at music sessions and competitions. Growing up in the social and political unrest of the 1970s and 80s Ireland meant that even at a young age, Karen's parents were aware of the isms and constructs that could impact their children. In a small Irish village where the church was the overwhelming authority on the culture, it was her mother who forged a different path for Karen.
My mother didn't really like the Catholic Church, and so she was asked if the local priest could come and do Stations of the Cross, and she said no. And so, you know, we were marked out a little bit differently in the village. And, she, you know, she liked to do her own thing. She liked to work and she had kids and she really wanted to work, I think. So that was different too, in a way. She was very glamorous, really beautiful. And, I think the church was very overbearing. We stopped kind of going to church when I was about 12 or 13. My parents took the unusual decision to send me to a Quaker school, not a Catholic school. So that was formative, really formative. I was really privileged to do that. It was a private school. And their friends actually persuaded them, because one of their friends, my mother's bridesmaid, was a Quaker, Rachel Lahan, amazing woman. So it was different. Like, there was 8 girls in the primary school, and when we were asked in sixth class, where are you going to school? And everybody else said the Mercy Convent or the Pres, whatever. And I said Newtown, the Quaker school. And there was this pause, and the principal said, oh, well, I wouldn't know anything about that place. It's fascinating, like, in Ireland, you think that we've gone beyond religion or sectarianism, but it very much permeates society. Not so much in the South anymore. You know, we're becoming a lot. We've certainly been freed from the shackles of the church. The one thing I learned at 13 was that you are not to get pregnant. It was a huge fear, and it was really, I think it was my mother's fear that I would become pregnant. And, you know, there were reasons for that that I learned only later on. But I definitely had an abiding fear of becoming pregnant. It didn't overshadow everything. I mean, to be fair, it was kind of like an unconscious thing. But when I look back now, I kind of go, oh my God.
I think historically, for many women, the idea of getting pregnant was the ultimate fear, the ultimate sin. And of course, we don't want a 13-year-old or any child to become pregnant. However, without proper education, context, freedom to explore and understand, the emphasis was placed on the outward manifestation of sexual activity and what that implied, and no consideration for the inner complexities and development of the human being. This warped imbalance stays with you well into adulthood.
I kind of threw myself into singing. I threw myself into sport. And I threw myself into various things, but mostly music. Listened to massive amounts of Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, you know, Top of the Pops. I loved all that. And I just loved music. It was a real way to escape. I had a tape recorder and I'd tape stuff on the radio, and I would then go down to my bedroom and learn it.
A woman came carrying 9 apples of gold, apples of gold on a bough.
I really feel free in songs. I really release, and they're a real balm. I can really, you know, escape into those songs. I've always found a huge freedom in singing. Well, I went through actually a phase of, for years, of having, trying to be perfect. And then certainly the last 10, 15 years, that's been a gift of letting go of that.
There's a force that permeates creative spaces in academia and professional settings. It's like we take this thing that is innate and free and mold it and shape it into something that can be assessed and analyzed. And don't get me wrong, study of your craft ultimately gives you the tools you need to truly explore all parts of your art. But sometimes we slip into a clinical approach that squashes all the beauty and sets artists on a never-ending path of working to legitimize their art instead of working to create it.
I did an amount of classical piano playing, and I loved the piano, but I could never, I found it hard to grasp that, so that was kind of hard. And then I also was doing, learning a traditional song and learning it in Irish, and I found that very hard. And I was trying really hard to get it right. I mean, I think it was because I was in competitions and exams, and really difficult exams. And I really, really, really tried and persevered, but, you know, I found that really hard. And that kind of gave me a bit of a, it's kind of seize up, you know, before playing and singing. But whereas I was at home and I'd be dancing around to Aretha. But somehow I don't know, I just, yeah, that just permeated a lot of, I find that in traditional music, the competitions, they're a huge part of it, and I don't know if that's really the way to go. I understand, like, learning and becoming better at something, but, you know, it's hard to get around that, I think. I started teaching when I was, I mean, I've been teaching all along, really, from, let's say, well, no, that's not true. I've been teaching probably more since, like, I've been about 42, and I started doing a lot more teaching, and you kind of teach the same way you were taught yourself. And then there were times when I was like, oh, this isn't really working. And I could see people were falling into the same thing and fearful, you know. And I just said, no, this is the wrong way to go about this. Let's not do this. So I suppose I had to see it in someone else in a way. And I had to unravel a lot of my own teaching and the way... And I had great teachers, don't get me wrong. They were really great and they were very kind. It wasn't anything like that. I think it's just... Classical music is, so much of it is about perfectionism, and indeed traditional as well. All of music, I suppose, can be very challenging. But yeah, so I started to try and think of it in a different way then.
I live in a country. I am the tongue, I am her tongue. I have one smooth tongue and I have one...
For a long time, maybe a majority of her career, Karen worked with the small boxes women are put into. She waded through the patriarchy in the only way she knew how.
We are the daughters
be pretty,
of the witches that you could
be sweet, maybe be quiet.
We are the daughters of
but
the
now, in this season, with a little more growing and learning, she's freed herself. Some of that has come with her sustained connection to the women and issues closest to her heart. And some of that has come with aging and, unexpectedly, in her journey through menopause.
Well, you know, it's funny, like, menopause certainly hasn't been talked about in Ireland, really, until 2 years ago. There was this radio program in the middle of the day, which I don't normally listen to. It's called Liveline. You know, it's actually very good in terms of that you've got, you know, ordinary people on there. You know, a lot of Irish radio is dominated by very great people, not, you know, but it can be very middle class. And you don't get a lot of just working class voices. And you do on this programme. Now, I don't love all of the aspects about the programme, but anyway, this woman rang in and started talking about the menopause. And they ran the menopause story for nearly 3 weeks.
Wow.
Because everybody was ringing in and saying, oh my God. And I was listening in and I was going, yes, all the symptoms, you know, the night sweats, the brain fog, the lack of confidence, the anxiety, your joints feeling, you know, out of kilter. And you just being, your whole system is out of kilter, really. And I hadn't named it, you know, so I was cross.
For those who are unfamiliar with this term, to be cross means to be vexed, annoyed, pissed off, angry.
I have been cross in the past, but I was really cross. And I was really cross sort of with myself and where I had ended up and what I was doing and what was I singing and why was I singing these songs and why was I coming along saying, oh, this is fantastic, thanks for having me, and kind of being the Irish Colleen or something, you know, which is like girl. And, you know, there was loads of things that I had wanted to say. And this is even going beyond that, further back. And I think the menopause just, it was so hard, actually, that I kind of had to stop and sit and go, Karen, what are you actually doing with yourself? You know, what do you want out of life? Stop pleasing people. Stop being running around on tour and sort of singing the songs that you think other people want you to sing.
I'm tired of being patient and kind and reserve the right to lose my mind. I'm tired of being patient and wise while viewing my demise.
And so it did really open up a huge area where I started talking about being a woman on the road, you know, the things that had happened where people, you know, were just not nice. They were, oh, beyond not nice, you know, telling me what to sing, constantly making comments about how I looked, being groped, harassed sexually, always told, oh my God, if I was 20 years younger. Actually, one guy said to me, if I was 10 years younger, and I said, you mean 20. You know, you know yourself. And I hid all that. And I hid what it did to me. Menopause is great. It's fantastic. I just want women to know that. Like, it's tough at times. But you also start going, no, no more. I'm done now. What do I actually want to do with my life? And how do I want the next phase of it to be? So it's actually a gift. It's also difficult sort of physically and psychologically, but in a way then struggling through that, you become a bit stronger, I think. You know, I want to make the world a better place with song. I'm kind of motivated by Christy Moore, Andy Irvine, Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, people who really have dedicated their lives really to changing the world and believing in the power of music, believing in community, believing that if you can get everyone into the room together, And even though we disagree, they'll all sing along to this song I sing called The King's Shilling. So, you know, even people who really disagree will sing along to the song. So there's something in that, and the power of that, and the potency of, you know, we can sing things, but maybe we're not able to say them. You know, very difficult issues, we can sing about them. My songs are dominated by anti-colonialism and anti-war songs. And colonialism is the same no matter where it is. You know, Palestine, Britain, Sudan, Syria, down here, down south in America, it's all the same thing. It's all trying to put one group down so as you can get ahead and so as you can make money. And all the warmongering and the death machines, they keep rolling on. I think that's one of the sad things, actually, about getting older, is that you recognise this war machine is going to keep going.
When you read or hear about Karen, her commitment to the issues of women and justice go hand in hand, especially in the more recent era of her career. Now, it wasn't always that way, and that's not because these weren't her values, but because, like many of us, she was invested in playing nice and doing what she thought she was supposed to do. I asked her if she held any grief or feelings about those years of her career.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. I probably still am. And I feel like I've no one else to blame, really, only myself. I sometimes kind of got in my own way. But I'm trying to be more kind, to myself.
Sorry. It's all right, my love. It's all right.
Yeah. Oh, God. I am, you know, I'm trying to say that I grew up, you know, in a country that, you know, put women away, locked them up, took their children away, sold their children. You know, obviously, the national question is so overbearing that, you know, it doesn't allow really for a conversation about women, about marginalised people. It does now. Thankfully, you know, we've changed an awful lot. So, you know, I'm trying to be kinder to myself in that. That's why I respond. But I suppose I still do it a bit, you know. It's the training that you get when you're young. To be nice, Karen, you know, never just stop answering back. Why are you saying that? You're difficult, you know, you're drama queen.
I asked Karen what she would say to her 30-year-old self.
Oh, I'd say fuck them. You know, I'd say, fuck them. That, you know, the things I wanted, like women to have choice, to have abortion in Ireland, like, I mean, I'm really proud of Ireland at the moment. There's thousands, hundreds of thousands walked last week for, you know, the anti-immigration has really risen its ugly head in Ireland. And it's really run by this maybe 200-300 people who come to where new immigrants are coming. These are people coming from war-torn countries. Yeah. And they're burning the house that those people are going to be put up in. And I'm so angry. And I'm so, after Ireland, you know, so many people emigrated, myself included, my parents. And then this is how we respond. Now, in fairness, most Irish people are going, this is terrible. My 30-year-old self thought, oh, well, if we sing all these songs and we get out and we protest, this will all change. So on some levels, that's very, I could give in to despair. And on other levels, I go, well, look, you know, things do get better. You know, we don't have children now working for 14 hours a day. And we have moved on with women's rights. I know it's kind of going backwards here in America, but we have moved on at home. So it makes you kind of, it's kind of quite contradictory, because I go, well, yeah, those were the things that we're all working for. But also it's a bit despairing, you know, the planet.
The episode isn't over yet, but I want to take a minute to say, Tell Her This needs your support. This is a self-funded project, but for less than a cup of coffee, you can keep this labor of love going. Click the link in the show notes to buy me a coffee, or head over to buymeacoffee.com/tellherthis and donate what you can. All right, let's get back to the show. I asked Karen about a time she felt most beautiful.
I am Irish, Rochelle. I mean, oh my God, it's probably a long time ago. I mean, well, actually, the other night we did a gig. I do these gigs in Ithaca. And I've been doing them for 28 years, and they're with these amazing activists called the Gradys up in Ithaca, and they do all this anti-war, anti-nuclear warheads. And they, you know, I go to benefits for them and I sing or whatever, and I do whatever they say, really. If they're doing something, I mean, we only meet usually once a year or twice a year. But I really love them, and I'm surrounded by love, and there's a community there, and they really, you know, I feel like I can speak openly, and we all sang together, and, you know, we talked about making the world a better place. You know, we've been through benefits where we were anti-war, anti the Gulf War, the war in Afghanistan, Iraq. You know, we've done so many benefits over the years. So we've a long relationship, and I really feel held by them and understood by that community. So that, actually, I felt beautiful that night on the stage, and I felt like connected. Yeah.
Karen was gracious enough to have our storytelling session before giving a full concert later that evening. She'd arrived quite late to the venue after her tour bus had been held up in traffic coming in from the previous tour stop. All that to say, I was very aware of the time and didn't want to compromise her preparation for the stage. But before we wrapped up, she made sure to tell me about the life of her dear friend, Dorothy.
I was going to tell you about a really good friend of mine. Yeah. So one of my, well, probably really one my best friend, her name was Dorothy Buchanan. And when I came to America first, which was 30 years ago, just January, I came actually to be a jazz singer because I wanted to be like Ella Fitzgerald. And I was a waitress, and I was babysitter. And I also got this job in a place called Scholastic, which edited children's books. And I got a job as an assistant editor with Dorothy in science books, which I know absolutely nothing about. I got the job because of my accent. Definitely. And anyway, she just changed my life. I met Dorothy. I was like, I don't know why I'm here. I got this job, I think, because of my accent. And she was like, oh, you'll do fine. And she was just an extraordinary woman. She passed away there in January. And she worked for 7 months of the year in Scholastic. And then she insisted that the other 5 months of the year she be allowed to go away and work on labour brigades. And she went to Guatemala. She built houses. She was in Puerto Rico. She built houses. She'd been in Germany outside Auschwitz and the Ravensbrück museums, beating her drum. She went on a huge walk. She was in Garvahy Road in Ireland, you know, as an overseer, an overseas observer. She actually invited me up to Garvahy Road for a holiday. And I was like, are you mad? This is like for marching season. Anyway, I went for a bit and she, you know, interviewed a lot of the women there, and she produced actually a book that, you know, documenting the women's lives there, what it was really like to grow up in fear. And she just did, you know, so many things. Her whole life was dedicated to eradicating poverty. She was an educator as well, and really, really radical. And, you know, her presence, you know, when I was kind of very clumsily in my early career trying to speak out against racism, or, you know, the burnt out black churches was one of the first benefits I did in America, or for Ireland, you know, Roisin McAlasky was a woman who was imprisoned in the north and chained to the bed when she was giving birth. So, you know, we were on a lot of different campaigns together. But I always had her overview, you know, and, you know, she'd fought so many good fights, and, you know, all my songs, I would run them by her. All my writing, she was so supportive. Write the song, write the books, keep saying what you're saying. And also very, you know, I'd be crying and upset, you know, over what this man did or this man said, or the fact that one guy got $400 and I got $200 for the same gig, or, you know, or the usual. And I always had her to be there and listen and be really supportive. And I'm just really glad that I had her in my life. I mean, what, you know, what a gift. She died of gallbladder cancer. And I actually was on tour in America here in November, and then I went to stay with her in Manhattan, in Queens, Sunnyside. And I was in the bedroom. She had a million books. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do with all the books. And beads, when she crocheted all the time, and she had all this science equipment, and she used to give it away to all the kids. And she was always teaching and really interested in children. And she would teach them about racism. And she would teach them the real history. And she would have the difficult conversation. And she would say, no, the kids need to know, and then they need to know what they can do. And she was so brave, you know, because we've all shied away so much from all these topics. She's just wonderful, and she was so kind to people. And one of the sad things is I don't know if she knew how much we all loved her. She was kind of surprised at the end that we were all coming and minding her. Sister, I am here for you. I was in the room looking at all the books going, she had asked me, could I start maybe cataloguing the books? And I was like, oh Jesus, like there were so many books. And I was really sitting on the bed crying, and she was in the other room, and she answered the phone, and she said, well, how are you today, young man? Because I have terminal cancer. I just wanted to tell you how grateful I am to have had her, and, you know, that she was, it was life-changing.
I asked Karen who she wanted to be at 70 years old.
I want to be like Dorothy. I want to be, I want to be still given out, you know, still an activist. I want to be in a community where I feel like I can draw on people, connect and still give. I want to be hopefully able-bodied, able to read. I read a lot. Just love. I don't want to be bitter. I really want to fight that. When I was 18, 19, I took it upon myself. I was in Mallorca. I had got this job singing in a bar and it didn't really work out. And so I said, because I was singing jazz and they didn't really want jazz, they wanted pop, whatever. Sting had made this tape with this Moroccan band and I got the tape and I loved it and I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. And I said, I'm going to go to Morocco. Right, so I took off to Morocco, oh, to be 19, 18. Didn't tell my mother really where I was going. I said, sure, look, I'll go to Morocco. And I went over from south of Spain, south, and went down to a taxi over the mountains. I was in Marrakesh and I had a contact of a family to stay with. And I was standing in like the town centre and it was absolutely beautiful and all the aromas and spices in the market. And of course I'm there like an idiot, a fool. I'd no hat. Karen. So I'd no hat. So I was feeling kind of sick. And then I went and I was staying in the youth hostel. And I was really sick. I had sunstroke and I went to bed. And the man behind the desk could tell that I was really sick and he said, you just need to go to bed. And then I was really sick, I was delirious in the bed, and every few hours he came in and he rubbed something in my head, kind of smelt like curry. And I must have been there for 2 or 3 days. And then I got up and I came out and he was on the floor praying with his mat. He didn't have to mind me. He didn't have to mind this mad Irish one from the middle of nowhere. And he did, you know. So I always try and come back to humanity, or us being tissue, blood, bones, and try and remind myself of that all the time. We all get caught up with trying to be famous or trying to do the right thing or say the right thing or sell albums, and doesn't matter a shite, you know, unless we're good to one another and kind and really doing that. Yeah, I don't know if I've always really been kind to everyone. I'm trying to push through, you know, and that's one of the things I think, even the menopause stuff, it's like, make me go. I need to slow down and just look at the really good things in my life and appreciate them and breathe, you know. Touring isn't really conducive to that, but you know what I mean? It is the actual important thing, and we need to connect with each other, and that's more important than being a superstar.
Deep gratitude to Karen for her time and her stories. The Tell Her This podcast was created by Rochelle Rice with support from DC Commission on the Arts and Humanities. To support this podcast, please click the link in the show notes or visit buymeacoffee.com/tellherthis. For more Tell Her This content, please visit tellherthispodcast.com and follow on social media at Tell Her This Podcast. Please share this episode with a friend and leave a rating or review. This episode includes music by Maya Rogers and today's storyteller, Karen Casey. Editing and sound design by Rochelle Rice. Mixing and editing by Ray Jala. And I'm your host, Rochelle Rice, and you can find me at Rochelle Rice Music across all social platforms. Until next time, be true and be well.